Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast thing that we do for people who do needle things.
There we go.
Yeah. Yeah. That one wasn't as good as the last one. Oh, well.
No, but we're going to make up for it because we're going global today.
We are. We're international. Jessica Grimm, all the way from Bavaria, joining us. Hi, Jessica.
Hello, Gary.
Yes, thanks for being with us here. Yes, we Christine and I first thing out of the gate in the morning so that we can get Jessica at the end of the workday there in Bavaria. So thanks for that.
You're welcome.
You have an interesting career. Now your life today is, as you describe it, a professional embroideress. I love that word, embroidery.
Yes, I like that.
Yes, as an element of class to it. But
I hope so.
But your previous career was archaeology and zoology, which intrigues me.
Boats.
So what was that all about?
It was all about bones from archaeological excavations. And I wasn't digging myself, or not much. But as soon as the animal bones came into the laboratory or the office, I looked at them and looked how old the animals were, how they were butchered, if they were poached, what else? If they were healthy. I like the pathology the best, to be very honest. It's a bit mean, but bone can do wonderful things when an animal isn't healthy.
Yeah, wow. You can probably tell more about it, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that was quite a nice career. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
So a lot of lab work then, huh?
Yeah. I was mainly inside, which is a good thing because archaeology takes place whatever the weather.
Yes. Yeah, I've never gotten excited about that end of the science world. It just seemed like a whole lot of paintbrush digging in dirt in the heat.
Not really. I never, ever had a paintbrush in my hand, to be very honest. Nowadays, everything needs to go so quickly because time is money. So it was more of a pickaxe.
Oh.
Yeah?
That works.
Yeah,
it does.
That'll dig. Yeah. So you're looking at, when you look at bones then, you're looking at nick marks from knives and those kinds of things? Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, smashing of skulls. As I said, the pathology when animals are really worked, like a draught oxen, or dogs often got kicked, and they have broken ribs. Yeah, yeah. A dog as a pet is a relatively new concept.
I'd say that's something you wouldn't expect to find, you know.
No.
We have this very romanticized view of archaeology, of only finding exciting dinosaurs, and then to find that, you know, things were different there out of necessity, and perhaps the uglier side of things, that's interesting because it adds a different layer.
It does, yeah. Yeah, and one of the things I found really interesting, it's a bit of an odd story, but years ago I read in the newspaper that young males are more prone to having a traffic accident because they are more prone to risk-taking when crossing a street and things like that. And then I looked at my animals, the wild living ones like cats and dogs, from which I could tell if they were male or female. And I saw the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And I found that so interesting. You get a lot of dead young males. And you think, okay, yeah, it must be the same thing at work.
So the dumb ideas are just a genetic thing, is what you're saying.
The risk-taking, maybe not looking twice and just go for it. Yeah.
So we really can't pick on them for things like that, can we?
Yeah.
It's just how they're wired.
I think so, too, yeah.
And once again, feeling outnumbered. Bummer.
Sorry, Gary.
That is interesting, though, that genetic thing is there. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'll make a point to. Well, that gives me actually it gives me an excuse to go do something stupid today. Okay.
Yeah, stay safe.
Yeah.
Well, and the funny thing is, between the two of us, which of us is the fast car and motorcycle rider? It's not Gary.
Nope.
So we bucked that a little bit for you.
Yeah.
You're getting out statistics then.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We're outliers.
Yeah.
She's definitely the risk taker. No doubt about that. So then what turns you to dump that career and do embroidery and needlework all the time?
Oh, yeah. It's a bit with the educational system. I'm sure it's the same in the U.S., that when you are a good learner, you end up at university at some point. And the whole working with your hands and having a vocation is just not really within your sight. You just don't think about it. You go to further education and you're good at learning. And yeah, at some point I just was at university and I thought, oh yeah, this is nice. But then you do that for a couple of years and you're in this very academic world where everything happens in your head. And I so missed using my hands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I very much appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that and the other thing that speeded up that I quit my career as an archaeologist, and I haven't quit completely, but 99% I have, was the fact that you are thought to think out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, everything needs to go so fast that we were given a pretty tight framework to do to work along to do our research. And there wasn't much time to do anything nice. So for me, it lost the point why I was doing it.
That's, you know, that's interesting because I used to be a science teacher and I would always say once I left that to get into magazine publishing, you know, I'd go back to teaching in a heartbeat if it could just be between, you know, when the bell rings and the door closes and it's just me and the kids. And yeah. I've changed that tune over the years as I've talked to other teachers because the same thing happens. You can't go and teach. You have this regimented curriculum that you must follow, and everybody who does science must be on the same page on the same day, and you lose that creativity, that ability to do something original and different that really inspires the students. And it sounds like the same thing for you. Just bang your way through it and get to an end and move on to the next one. And yeah, it kind of sucks the life out of it.
It does. I was basically just signing off parcels of land and freeing them up for development. And that's not what archaeology should be about. It's about our past and what we can learn from it and how it can inspire us today. And what I find really difficult, people don't relate so much to archaeology. I mean, they did in the UK where I used to live, but not so much in the Netherlands. That was really difficult to get the story across. And I found it more and more difficult to work along this very strict framework to just answer certain questions and don't do anything else. That's not why I studied archaeology.
Yeah, I understand that.
And I think, so going back to your point of being a scientist and not working with your hands, it's sort of an interesting way that science builds a career path, which is, and I'm interested if archaeology bends the same way as the more traditional, you know, bench scientists do, which is when you start out, you spend all of your time on the bench doing experiments and work and building things and inventing. And the better you get at that and the more you advance in your career, the less time you have to spend doing exactly that on the bench. So the older you get and the more higher ranking, I guess, you get or the further along you go, the further away from the thing that drew you to it you go. So I feel the same way. So I started as a bench scientist, and the more I worked, and I have to support a family, so you seek a career path that takes you above that, and then you look back a year later and say, wow, I haven't made anything in a year because I've been busy managing other people making things. So, and I think that's where I come back to. Before this, it was reef keeping, and now it's needlepoint. It's exactly the same thing, as I miss having something to do with my hands. I miss making something and having something to show for it at the end, besides, some document I wrote on a computer. So your mind does science, but your body doesn't any longer. So you need to re-engage.
I can completely relate to what you're saying. You end up being a manager, and you're constantly chasing the money.
Yes. Or thinking of ideas, in my case, thinking of ideas and then giving them to somebody else and saying, build this for me. When really I would love to spend an afternoon just building things, right? So then I just come home and I sew, and then it makes it better.
So while you were doing archaeology, was needlework in the evenings and weekends?
Not much. I still did a bit. I did my Christmas cards, and I did the normal cross stitch, and I think I did one bigger piece of Richelieu, and that was it, I think.
No. So then to leave archaeology and do this full time, that was a bit of a leap then.
We were moving back from England to the Netherlands, so I was in between jobs anyway. I did do a bit of archaeology when we were back in the Netherlands, but I had already started at the Royal School of Needlework because I wasn't feeling too happy in my
Calm
job
down,
anyways.
Christine. Calm down,
Yeah,
Christine.
I know, I know. I'm
Who the
dying to
next were?
go. I'm dying to go, so I can't wait to hear about that. So go ahead, continue.
Yeah. So I was on a weekend away with my husband to London, and we were innocently visiting Hampton Court. And at some point,
Yeah,
my
innocent.
husband said, look at this. And he pulled out a flyer of the Royal School of Needlework, and he said, oh, well, you can study embroidery here. And I was like, oh, yeah. And the next Monday, I was back at Hampton Court in a day class.
Well played,
So,
Jessica. Well played.
that was really, it happened then so fast because I wasn't feeling happy at my job, and it got very frustrating. And I thought, I need to do something else, but what else can I do? And then I thought, oh, well, yeah, go back to embroidery. I always liked it, and I come from a line of embroiderers. Both my paternal grandma was an embroideress, and my maternal grandpa was an embroiderer as well. So I'm infected with the virus from both sides, and I went to the Royal School.
Okay, all right. Help Christine tell about the Royal School. Give us a tour.
So, and a one day class. So that's sort of a nice way to have the experience without, signing up for months and months. So what was that like?
I think my first day class was, I think it was gold work. Yeah, it was gold work with Kelly Aldridge. Now Kelly is really crazy. She's from Canada, but she has so much enthusiasm and energy, and she was wonderful during the day. I had a really, really exceptional experience. I had never done any gold work before, and it was just so much fun, and we were such a nice bunch of people. It was just great. So I signed up for 4 day classes. I did the gold work one.
Of course.
She's sucked in now.
Well, I mean, it's Hampton Court. How can you really not be? And it's the Royal School, so yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. And it was still in the old school. They have now moved to the other side, But I was still in the original classroom that's overlooking the gardens very beautifully. I think the new rooms do as well, but it's just a part of the palace I'm not so familiar with. And yeah, I had a really great day. And then I went for my second day class, which was a white work class with Kelly as well. And I think at the end of that one, I signed up for the certificate. Yeah, I was in there, head over heels.
So to be certified then, what is entailed in that? To be part of a certificate program, it's not just a class here and there.
No, it's 4 modules, and you are strongly advised to start with crewel work embroidery. Then you move on to either silk shading or gold work, and you need to do both of them. And then you have a choice of canvas work or black work, and you choose one of them. And when you progress onto the diploma, you have to do the one that you didn't choose, and you have to do other modules as well. And
And do you do all of the work sitting in the school with in classroom time, or is a little bit of the
no.
classroom time and the rest is take home time?
Yeah. What I actually did, because when I signed up for the certificate, I did do 2 modules in England, and then we moved back to the Netherlands. And then I used to come over for 2 weeks in a row and do my 8 class days. And then the rest of the time, I would work in my apartment where I was staying. And you work till late at night, because I think every project you do is about 120 to 150 hours of stitching.
Yes.
So you will never be able to complete that in 8 classes. There's a lot of homework, but that's fun.
Okay, well,
Yeah,
goals.
so you should go, Christine. It is really, really nice.
Yes, I have I would love to, and now it's just a matter of logistics. So how can I, and so this actually works out well for me, because figuring out the logistics of getting there for a sufficient amount of time to actually do a good program, it's going to take a little while, but that allows me to actually build some skill, so that instead of walking in and getting, it to me, to go to the Royal School is a privilege. So I want to go with a good background. I want to go with a substantial amount of skill to begin with, and then allow that to be the fine tuning and where I can see someone becoming just really, really proficient as something, as opposed to going there as a beginning and learning, well, this is a pin stitch, and this is how you start and end your work. That to me would be a waste. So I want to build some skill on my own and then go and be able to learn sort of the mastery of something. So while I'm working out the logistics of how it is I can disappear from the United States for 2 weeks, that allows me some time to build up those skills so I can, hit the ground running and really be able to learn the finer art of it.
That's interesting, because I used to teach for them as well, and what we actually said is that we like students coming in as green as possible.
Really?
Because they won't have any bad habits
Yes.
that we need to
Okay,
weed
that's
out
fair
of them.
too. Okay, so I have to increase my logistical planning and bring that forward. Or do things that I haven't done, right? So, gold work and black work, those are things that, are particularly interesting and historically relevant in England too. So those are things I haven't tested yet. So that would be fun to do.
What's the culture like there? I mean, obviously the expectations for a result are very high. I mean, I have no doubt about that. But is it a fairly relaxed culture, or rather rigid? What's it like in the classes? Is it fun?
It is great fun. It is really nice to be in a classroom with people all wanting to be there. There's nobody there held against their will, which you sometimes have in university. And it's you spark ideas of each other.
Oh.
because it is very international. You will mostly have classes with people not from the UK. And that is brilliant. Everybody comes with their own cultural bagage, and it just melts into something new, and you see so much because you only have your own pair of hands to stitch with. You can never ever do everything that's out there, but you can sort of be part of it by seeing what other people do. So it is very enriching.
And also that way for you as a teacher.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I love to teach because, again, it means that I don't need to stitch everything myself. I can just make a suggestion to somebody and say, well, you do it, and I'll see how it works.
How long did you teach there?
I did about a good year. And then I moved to Bavaria, and things were just logistically not ideal to continue teaching for them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure not. And but in that year, you know, a year seems like not very long. But I got to believe that you paraded through a ton of classes in that year, especially if they're 1 and 4 day classes.
Oh yeah, I did. I went to America with them, which was a great privilege.
Oh.
Yeah, that was really nice because they did the, I think they still do the intensives in America where they just stitch for 8 days in a row.
Yes.
And that was brilliant. A whole different culture. I had never been to America before, so yeah, I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Got the full experience there out of out of the school then.
Oh yeah, I did. Yeah, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity that was given for me to actually teach for a while. That was really nice.
Yeah. So you moved to Bavaria, and was it your intention to open a studio there and start offering classes?
Yeah, that I thought, well, I can teach embroidery anywhere I like because there are not many people on the on in continental Europe who want to stitch or embroider this kind of embroidery to learn it. So I thought anywhere where I live, they will come to me anyway because there are not many teachers either.
Yeah.
And it sort of worked out. Yeah, I live in a very beautiful surrounding on the edge of a national park, and it is brilliant for people to come here and learn embroidery and go walking and go sightseeing. So yeah, I moved.
Here, typically we see tons and tons of classes in needlepoint, and you tend to see a lot of the same types of classes or the same types of styles, and then very few classes of more, unusual things like black work, as you mentioned before. And I wonder if that is, in your experience, driven by the fact that people just don't like those styles as much as doing regular needlepoint or painted canvas, or if it's because of a lack of exposure and a lack of good teachers. Like, what styles do you find are underrepresented that maybe could, be done by more people if they knew that it existed?
I think definitely black work, because people always think that is just filling squares with different patterns instead of trying to do a picture and get the shading right. What I always find, as soon as I have a class in gold work, they always fill. That seems to be, people are great magpies. As soon as it glitters, it's okay.
That's
And one of
true.
the things that is really difficult here is getting people turned on to needlepoint. They
And
don't
you
seem
think
to
that's an
like it.
entry? They don't like needlepoint.
No.
I
Whereas
find
I
that
think, interesting.
that yeah, that's hard to believe. I'll be darned.
Right,
Yeah,
because
I know.
here it's the opposite. I think that the embroiderers are well overwhelmed by the needlepoint people as far as quantity. I don't know, Gary, you would probably know better than I do because you have more experience and more exposure to the outside world. But it seems like there's way more needlepointers. And what I've found here in New York is that when you go to shops, one of my sort of difficulties is you go into a shop and it's filled with painted canvases, and then even charted work is difficult to find here. And then any kind of kits for or materials for embroidery are just impossible to find. So I feel like here, probably needlepoint is the vast majority of what happens, and there's very little other work being done. And I find that interesting. Then why is that? What is it about embroidery or going off the grid, as someone said very cleverly? What is it about that either is unappealing to people or intimidating? And what do you think it is?
I think it's the skills and the experience to just dive in, to try it out. Because to be honest, if you're having a painted canvas, or in this part of the world, cross stitches is very popular, follow the pattern and the result will be sort of okay, even if you are not a very good stitcher, even as a complete beginner that has thread tension wrong and has mangled threads, it will still have the outcome that's on the packaging. Whereas with all the freestyle embroidery going off the grid, I love it. It depends on your own creativity. And I find that a lot of people don't trust their own creativity, whereas I think just dive in and try out.
It is a bit of a leap of faith, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, and I think that's it. It's people don't trust. And we've said this before. It's you have to be willing to fail.
Yeah.
Right. So, and it's hard to fail. Like you said, it's a painted canvas, and with all due respect to painted canvas stitchers, now that I've looked at them a little bit more, I understand where the appeal is and where some of the challenges are. There's tremendous challenges, but those are easy to do adequately and more difficult to do, you know, beautifully. Whereas I think people see, you know, fabric embroidery as a little bit more difficult to do even adequately, right? So the point of entry is a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you remember the fox I did after the drawing of Milly Marotta.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think I sent you the picture as well. I described the whole process on my blog, how I did it, how I came up with the image, how I did my thread choices, what kind of stitches I used, how I transferred the design onto the fabric. So basically, if you read through my blog post on the topic, you could make a copy. And I'm still contacted by people asking if I can do a more detailed pattern of the fox, which for copyright reasons I can't. And that for me illustrates that people are really, really unsure to take the plunge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to me, that piece is such a great example of something that, you know, I look at it and I just think that what fun that is, because you can't get bored in it because there's so many different things in there. You have surface work, you have different types of stitches in the surface work, you have, you know, wired slips, you have all kinds of different things going on here. And I suppose that's something that people could do, you know, if they looked at this and said, okay, well, this is too difficult for me. There's plenty of places where you could replace one stitch that maybe you were intimidated by with something different. And maybe that's the part too, that people have a hard time with. In fact, a lot of instructors or designers say they're always surprised when people ask permission to change a design. And they say, well, of course you can change it. It's yours. So, you know, something like this fox that looks, you know, to me, it looks, I'm immediately attracted to it and I want to try it because there's, you know, so many different things in there that are different and new. But if you wanted to simplify it, you could do that by just choosing different types of stitches and maybe just, you know, using fewer things going on there. So it's all adaptable, but people have to be willing to adapt it. And I think that's the fear is, like you said, if a piece is going to take 150 hours to do, there's a little bit of trepidation about saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to put 150 hours into it. And then at the end go, nope, that didn't work at all. And you have to be willing to do that because otherwise you don't know what does work, right?
No. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I really like the idea of just stitching my fox, and I'm now doing it every month with the broderie box by Nordic Needle. And I just used only the things that are in the box and come up with some sort of design, mostly from the books by Milly Marotta, and just stitch doodle. And it's not it's not big girl embroidery, but it's just fun. And things go wrong, and sometimes I'm stuck with horrible colors, and I'm thinking, oh no, I would have never picked this. But that is such a fun challenge to do. And of course, there are not things that will go into the National Museum of Bavaria in Munich, but hey, they don't have to go there.
Yeah, so you know what though? You just brought up a really interesting point. I have a friend who is a comic book cover artist. This is all he does, right? He does comic book covers. And for a while, he had a blog. So bear with me because I'm going to go somewhere with this. For a while, he had a blog of bad covers. And the whole point of this was not so much to, it was not at all to poke fun at other covers and say, this is terrible art or this is wrong or, you know, look how great I am because this other artist is bad. I mean, he would use some of his own covers as examples of bad art. But the point of it was to say, here was something that somebody tried and it didn't work and here's why. So we all look at beautiful pieces all the time and we say it was beautiful because it has this color or because it has this balance and this composition. But how useful would it be to have a compendium of bad stitchery and then look at each one and say, all right, well, what makes this not appealing, right? Because it's not bad because it's teaching us something. So what makes this not a museum piece? Well, like you said, maybe you chose colors that, well, didn't exactly complement each other the way that you wanted to. And if you were going to do it differently, this is what you could do. Or here's a piece that, you know, got started on the right foot, but the person that was stitching it wasn't familiar with this particular fiber. So you can see how it shredded. And so simply by using shorter lengths, you could make it better. Like it would be difficult to get people to submit pieces of bad embroidery or bad needlework. But what a great learning tool that would be, because instead of making those mistakes yourself, you could look at somebody else's mistake and say, oh, yeah, I don't want to do that. So I'm going to avoid that.
Yeah,
So now I
I think
almost
it's a
want to do
brilliant idea.
a blog of bad stitchery, right? Because, and believe me, I'm more than happy to populate that with plenty of my own terrible work, because that's how you learn. You know, that's how I learn is by doing things wrong. So, you know, just even as something as simple as, you know, stitching I just did a felt padded daisy and I did it and then I said, nope, didn't do that right because, and I look at it now and say, you know, what I needed to do is just extend the stitches maybe another 3 millimeters out and it would have been beautiful. But that's a perfect example of taking a picture of that and saying, here's a case where I tried something and it didn't work out, and here's how I could fix it. You know, I kind of like that idea, but it would take bravery on the part of the people submitting pieces to say, I did bad work. But we all do it. So, you know, that's the thing. It also gives people permission to admit that they're not perfect all the time because you can't be perfect all the time, Gary. Gary's perfect all
What?
the time.
What? Huh?
Gary will never ever put a piece on my imaginary blog of bad stitchery because it would just be anathema to him.
What?
In Gary's world, all stitches have to be perfect, and if they aren't, then they get ripped out and destroyed and never to be acknowledged or to be seen in the light of day. And I go the opposite way and say there's plenty of bad stitches, and those bad stitches were what led to the good stitches. So we kind of have different philosophies on that.
Yeah, that's actually I agree with you, Christine. I was taught that route at the Royal School of Needlework because being a teacher there meant that I also did a fair lot of assessing. And as long as we could see that somebody progressed in a piece, it meant that it didn't need to be completely perfect from stitch one till stitch whatever. But as long as you can see that somebody grows, it's enough.
Yes.
And that is so important. I sometimes with my teaching samples, I actually leave some stitches that aren't very perfect and say to
Yeah.
people, look, that's what happens if you don't do as I say.
Right. Well, and it's a good, you know, we it's a good people relate more to visual things, right? If they can see something. So, you know, there's a concept of, all right, if you stitch with this particular silk and you do this, it's going to shred, so don't do that. But if you can show them, here, I stitched this whole section in satin stitch with a thread that had, you know, shredded because the eye was, you know, a bird or something like that. And look at that next to what it could have looked like if I had swapped out the needle, then people, that's a very good visual kind of thing that people remember, I feel like, you know. And it's only when I see it in my own work and go, wow, I just wasted a good bit of time because I was lazy and didn't, and just wanted to barrel through, you know. And so I think I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to start taking taking pictures of terrible things I've done. I'm really enamored with this idea.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting, that is, it's the broderie box. Is that what it's called? That you get from Nordic Needle? I think that's interesting because, yeah, I often think about, everybody's always offering a, you know, a thread pack of the month, club or something like that. And so you just take that box, whatever comes in it, and try and make something out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I try to do it every month. I must say I haven't done this month because the whole Christmas market season is nearly upon us, and I need to produce stuff that I can sell. But yeah, that's what I do. I just open the box, and for me it's all sorts of threads that are not available in continental Europe. You can get them in London from one particular shop, the London Bead Company. It is very unknown stuff to us, like the velvety threads, and then there's a lot by Karen, like the water lilies and the watercolors and whatever is out there. And that's just stuff we don't have. Here in Germany, it's particularly bad. What they do have is anchor, stranded cotton.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it.
Wow.
And that is such a shame because there are so many very nice threads out there. And I thought I'm going to do this subscription box for a year and just see what's out there.
Every time I hear that, I'm amazed that you guys in Europe don't have access to what we have here. It just amazes me.
Yeah, yeah. That is interesting because I'm doing a lot of show work. So I sit in a museum and stitch. And we get quite a lot of Americans because I'm the museum is in Oberammergau and there's a NATO school.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in and they ask me all sorts of questions. And we talk a bit about embroidery and crafting in general. And they always assume that here on the continent, we appreciate needlework much more than in America or in England. And I always have to correct them that is not true. It's the other way around.
And see, that's the assumption that I've always made is that the mother load of needlework is in Europe, and if you really want serious needlework and want to learn from serious people, you go there. But wow,
I mean, it does hold true for the Royal School of Needlework. That really is a center of excellent learning. Come up with a comparable place in Germany where you can really learn every form of embroidery. Not really. I'm a private person who can teach quite a wide variety of embroidery. And then there are other teachers, not many, who are very proficient in one or two techniques. And that's it, or at least I haven't found them so far. And they haven't found me.
Yeah, I wanted to learn a little bit more about what you do, your studio, and the different kinds of things you offer, because you offer quite a broad range of classes. Tell about how you got that started and how it's kind of evolved over time and how you handle your classes.
I think it's still very much the way as I was taught with the Royal School of Needlework, because I like their quality. They really teach you the basics and teach them well, and then they expand. And I think it's important that you don't start to run before you can walk. Mm-hmm. and do things a certain way to maximize success, very honestly. And what I like to do, what I found out in Germany, normally the classes were a bit longer. They lasted from 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Whereas at the Royal School, it was always 10 o'clock till 4. And what I noticed is that being focused and having the energy to survive from 9 till 5, almost nobody has. So I actually shrunk my class time, and it worked much better. Yes. So I basically still do as I was taught, and yeah, because I think that's the best way, to be very honest.
And you have your own studio there at your home?
Yeah, it used to be, I think, the living room, and
Okay.
it's
Oh,
it's the
I used to
largest.
have one of those. Yeah, well, it's the largest room in my apartment, and it overlooks the Alpine Lake. It's very beautiful. It has large windows, so I have good lighting, and I can seat about 5 to 6 people, and it's directly off my kitchen. So I can actually, when I do my embroideries, we always eat together during lunch. And I can actually have an eye on my students whilst cooking, which is very clever.
Yes.
And it's a very nice arrangement.
Yeah, working at home, nothing like it. Nothing like I
Says
want.
the person who works from home to the person who drives an hour and a half to work.
Yep. My office is 5 feet away. Yep. It's perfect. Works just fine. Yep. I wanted to ask about I now I've been criticized for not doing research ahead of time. A lot of times that's intentional, but and I didn't do it this time. Silesian white work and Appenzell embroidery, those are two I'd never heard of.
No, I think most people haven't.
Okay,
The
good.
Silesian white work is actually a form of white work from the people from Silesia, which was a part of Germany before the Second World War. And what it is it is from that traditional folk costume. It is a form of white work. It used to be a very, very fine form of white work on what is it on sheer linen, I think it is very, very veil linen, I think it is. Yeah, it's very thin. It is transparent, and they would do their white work embroidery on top. It doesn't have a huge array of stitches. They use very a lot of chain stitch and buttonhole. They cut out pieces and weave needle lace into it. And it used to be rather fine with linen threads on linen, but nowadays it's really hard to get the particular type of linen is no longer made because it was made in Silesia and it no longer is. And even the linen threads is a bit difficult, although I have found pretty good substitute through the lace makers. So it's quite a nice form of embroidery, but there are very few people who still practice it and who can actually teach. And then the Appenzeller embroidery is also white work. It's very fine, and it's actually not stitched in white. It's in very pale blue.
Ooh.
And it is very beautiful. Very difficult to do, but very, very beautiful.
That's the that those I'll use the word obscure, but those obscure stitching techniques fascinate me, where they come out of one culture and have a lot of history to them. And it's too bad that some of the just the basic materials disappear and you can't do them anymore.
No, that's the same with the Appenzell embroidery, because the very fine blue threads, and they are really fine. They are finer than a normal sewing thread. They are just no longer produced. And even the linen, again, that is not produced anymore. Yeah, a real shame.
Yeah, that is. That is. So what's a typical day for you? Well, you, oh, actually I was more curious about this the Christmas market Now, you because you mentioned that's going to occupy or is occupying your time. What is that all about? Do you stitch, is it something you stitch a bunch of pieces to sell, or how does that all work?
Well, to be very honest, I don't know because I've never done it before.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
One of the difficulties for me here in Germany, and it was a bit in the Netherlands as well, people are not living their lives online so much as Americans or even the Dutch, I think, do. So it is very hard to reach people. And to make yourself known. Particularly where I live here, people read newspapers. Well, that's excellent, but the newspaper ad is really expensive. So that doesn't help me much. And people suggested that I should go out more and be on markets and craft markets and things like that. And I thought I'd start for the Christmas period. So I'm going on to a very nice one early November. It's next week actually, and that's in an old farmstead, and it will have 31 craftspeople and the more exotic ones. Like I don't know if you read my blog a couple of weeks ago about this Vederkuil stickerij, the ones that work with the peacock feathers.
Oh, yes. I want to ask more about that
They're
because,
stunning.
oh man, that's amazing stuff.
Oh, it is. I'm so excited to actually see somebody work that live because I've never seen it live. I've always seen the little YouTube videos and seen the products, but never see somebody do it.
I couldn't believe when that, because I've read your blog for a long time, and when that one popped up here, was it last week or so? I was showing my wife. I said, "You got to see this. They're taking that's the quills of peacock feathers, right? That they slit real fine and basically use that as sewing thread in leather. Wow, that's so pretty. Yeah, and it looks like heavy leather too. It looks like they're really working with thick, heavy leather." Oh, it's beautiful work. I can't imagine. There can't be too many people doing that kind of thing, I wouldn't think.
Well, there is a whole revival of it, I think. There are more and more sort of mid-age people, young people, it's always difficult to reach them, but say mid-age people, 40 plus, who are now trying to learn it. But it is really difficult. I did a bit of stitching on leather, and what I find so difficult, your needle swims. Where you stick it in on one side is not necessarily where it comes out on the other side. Because of the thickness, and it is different layers as well. You've got the top layer, and then there's a different layer in the middle, and another different layer on the other side, and they sort of move. And I find it really difficult to stitch to be accurate.
It swims. I like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that technique, that's amazing, and the end product, just that stark white quill and on the leather is just gorgeous stuff. What amazing stuff! Yeah, you do some jewelry too. You've been producing some beaded jewelry that I found is beautiful stuff. What gets you into that? Just outside the box stitching?
Yeah, I do some I still follow workshops myself because I always like to learn. I think when you sign up for working with your hands, it is lifelong learning. And I learned to make these pendants and I thought, oh, that's nice. It's still stitching. It is something that goes relatively quick and you can sell it because the biggest problem, you asked me about the Christmas markets, I will try to sell some embroidered pieces, but people are not willing to pay you minimum wage for it. And with the jewelry, because it goes so quick and people are generally prepared to pay a bit more for jewelry, I think I can actually, sell a bit.
Yeah, somebody posted the other day about that whole thing where she was looking to sell her embroidery or her needlework, and then of course the pricing of that, and then the mindset that you're selling art, not needle and thread. And it, you have to view it as art and price it and value it accordingly. That it's yeah, because too often people just think, well, that's just needle and thread, that's cheap. But no, it's that skill, it's the talent, it's the color understanding, the balance, all those things that make art. And so she, that's what she was dealing with. And I just thought it was an interesting discussion about how we look at our needlework, because yeah, I mean, for people to pay and compensate us for the time and talent and energy that goes into what we make. I mean, the relative cost for materials is trivial, but the time and what
the
goes
hours.
Into it, you know, that gets expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I very often get asked, oh, how much does it cost? And then I usually reply, no, I'm not going to argue with you about it. It is not important. I'm not selling it. But people keep nagging you. They really want to know. And when you give them a figure, they all go, oh, nobody can afford that. No, no, no. You can afford it. You just don't want to. You choose to spend your money on something else. And that's absolutely fine. But stop making these remarks all the time. I'm sitting there. You can visit me for free. You can ask me questions. And every second question is about the money. And it is sometimes really, really personal. Really like, can you pay your rent by doing this? And I'm sort of, I'm not asking you if you can pay your rent, so stop asking.
Yeah, it does. It keeps coming back to money. And I gave a gift one time, and it was, first question was, how many hours do you have in it? Just appreciate it for what it is. It's, you know, quit trying, don't try to put a value on it. Yeah, just, it's a beautiful thing to look at and enjoy. It's yours. You know, say thank you and move on. Just
yeah, it's this idea that it needs to have a monetary value, and I think my pieces are for enjoyment, and you don't need to buy them. I mean, I'm very happy when you do, but don't constantly try to make it so economic and see if it's economical that I work these things, because of course it's not in our modern world.
Right.
But I think we still need craftspeople, because they are a link with our past, and I think they can teach us for the future and for the direction we should go.
Yeah, and I think somebody not too distant past that we talked to, I asked the question about, are we seeing the younger people start to look at crafts in general, something to do with their hands, something they can make rather than just staring at screens all the time. And the person said, yes, that she felt that was happening, that young people were starting to look for things like needlework and what they, the satisfaction. And yeah, like Christine said earlier, I made something, it's mine, you know, I did this. And that's good. I mean, I'm encouraged by that. We need more of that, where people are sitting down in their spare time and doing something constructive and something that's relaxing at the same time. And then there's a product at the end that they can hold up and say, yep, I'm pretty proud of that. That worked out. I made that. And I hope we see more of that. I mean, the hobby needs younger people in general to keep going, the whole needlework hobby, but to have that enthusiasm because once a few start doing it and the word spreads, then you get more and more, it geometrically just grows. And so it would be great. Do you see young people in your classes? Are you getting younger people?
No, unfortunately not. The youngest people are around my age, so late 30s, early 40s. But one of the other things,
oh, those are kids. Those are absolute kids.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
I know. But I like to have the real kids if possible. But one of the other things that I notice is that I get more and more asked to do online classes, mm-hmm. and I'm not opposed to them. I can see that they are a big added bonus for people who can't travel or who are on a different continent. I completely appreciate. But I like the needlework and the crafting because you meet people and it's about the stories and actually seeing each other. And that you don't have with an online class.
Right. Yeah, that's so true, 'cause yeah, you don't get the camaraderie, the you know, and like you suggested at the Royal School there, where you get ideas from people, and you know, everybody grows from that. Still can't believe you guys don't have every thread in the planet over there. That's just not right.
No, not at all.
We're gonna have to bundle some up and ship them over.
Oh, yes, care packages.
No, I actually when I order supplies, they come from everywhere. The gold threads come from either the UK or Vienna. Then my pearlé comes from South Africa. Then my wool comes from England. Then I've got Chinese silk, and then all the specialty threads come from America.
Oh, you're truly international.
Oh yeah.
Is gold work material getting harder to come by? I mean, fewer suppliers?
Yeah, I think so. But I still have the one in Vienna. They still make threads, and there are still people in the UK who make them, but there's nobody left in Germany who does them.
That whole area of stitching, not just because it shines, but it intrigues me because there's such dimension to all of the threads and bits and pieces that you put down on the ground cloth. Such dimension, and you, depending on how you put it down, the reflections you get, it just seems like a really, really interesting, different challenge. It's not, I don't, I haven't really seen that it looks all that tough to do, other than it must be slow and tedious at times. But depending on what you do with those threads, you can really generate some interesting reflections and dimension.
Yeah, it's a whole different kind of stitching. It has far more to do with beading techniques and the whole padding from the stump work. And one of the things I needed to get my head around is that, yeah, you need to be very precise, but there is a limit to the precision with which you can stitch because the thread itself has a certain sturdiness and a certain form. And it was never meant to be viewed very up close because it comes from the liturgical vestments and the robes from the king, and you were looking at them by candlelight, and it was just dazzling, and you weren't inspecting them up close. And that was a thing I needed to get my head around. That yeah, you need to be very precise and stitch neatly. But there's sort of a limit to the neatly you can get, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, they only give so far, huh? Yep, stand back, enjoy it from a distance. Yes. Jessica, this has been a lot of fun. We need to wrap up here, but thanks for making the time. It's been really fun to talk with you.
Yeah, this is brilliant. This is so nice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us.
Yep,
Yeah, you're
and
welcome.
classes, jessicagrim.com. That's Grim with two M's, jessicagrim.com, and links on the page for this podcast so that you can find her. But classes over there, so you know, if you're going to Europe, you know, get your butt to Bavaria there, and Jessica will teach you something. It'll be good.
I promise I'll do it.
All right, thanks to everybody for listening, and Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.